Steve Barry has captivated millions of readers with his best-selling novels. He's also the co-founder of History Matters, a nonprofit organization dedicated to preserving our heritage. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'll talk with Steve Barry about his latest novel, The Columbus Affair, the role that history plays in all of his novels, and how he takes inspiration from little-known historical facts. We'll also talk about his work in historic preservation and the role that all of us can play in preserving the history around us. He'll be speaking in Des Moines on Thursday as part of the Avid Lecture Series. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me today is best-selling novelist Steve Barry. His thrillers have been translated into 40 different languages and have reached millions of readers around the world. It has been said that if Ian Fleming and Doris Kearns Goodwin had a love child, Steve Barry would be that child. Many of his novels, all of his thrillers, in fact, take some inspiration from history. His latest novel is called The Columbus Affair. In this hour, we'll talk about his latest novel. We'll also talk about his work in historic preservation. Hello, Steve.
How you doing?
Great. Thank you so much for being with me today.
It's great to be here.
And you are a lawyer, which is not the traditional pathway to becoming a best-selling novelist, with the exception of, I guess, John Grisham. But when did you start writing?
I started writing in 1990. I was 35 years old. I had not written a word in my life until then. I had a little voice in my head. Every writer I've ever met, including Grisham, has a little voice in their head that tells them to write. And you ignore it as long as you can, and then eventually you learn that if you write, it'll shut up. If you don't, it'll keep nagging you. And I finally started writing in 1990, but it took me 12 years from the day I wrote my first word to the day I sold my first word. And I wrote 8 manuscripts. 5 were submitted to New York houses, and they were rejected 85 times.
What kept you going?
The little voice. It truly is. It's just that little voice in your head. It tells you to write. It doesn't tell you to write a bestseller or anything like that. It doesn't say that. It just says, will you please sit down and write? If you'll sit down and write, I will not nag you to death. If you don't, I'm going to just bug you every day. And it kept me going. Now, I'm not going to tell you, I'm not a Superman. I quit 3 times during that 12 years. I said, this is kind of silly. You know, this is ridiculous. It's never going to happen. But each time, after a few days, the little voice would come back and say, okay, back to work now. Let's go.
Your novels take inspiration from history, as I mentioned before. How does that process work for you? Is there some sort of historical nugget that you read about, that you find out about somewhere that works its way into your brain?
Yeah, it's just like with the new book, The Columbus Affair. My new novel is out now. I stumbled onto a book in a used bookshop. I don't want to say what that book is because it'll give away the secret of the story, but it's referred to in the back of the novel if anybody wants to read it. I stumbled onto that book. I found it. I read it. I went, wow, this is pretty cool. I think this could be a novel. I think we could take this little nugget here and I could make a novel out of it. And that's how that one came about. It's just one of those things. I put that book on my shelf and it sat there for several years until I was ready to write this standalone. And then I decided to go with this thing on Christopher Columbus. And I've had other ideas like that. I got an idea walking through the Kremlin, you know, for the Romanov prophecy. And I was listening to the Discovery Channel, and that's where the Amber Room came from. You never know where they're going to come from. It's just, they're good. It's good that they come, and I hope they keep coming. And it's a writer's job to recognize them and to grab them when they do wander by.
How quickly do you recognize them? Is it something that comes back to you after a few weeks after you stumble across something?
It's instantaneous, usually.
Instantly.
Yeah, but I look at it and go, like, that can be a story. Yes, that's a story. That can make a story out of that. Now, how that story comes about takes many, many months of thinking to put together, but the actual nugget that this could be a novel, it comes pretty quickly when I hear it or see it.
What do you do then? Do you start researching?
No, I file it away. I have a shelf here of a lot of those ideas that may never, ever make it anywhere. Just like the Columbus one, I put it on that. I found that book about 5 years ago, and I put it on the shelf here. And I keep a shelf here of just like books and things that I come across that have these interesting concepts in them. And And then when I'm getting ready to do the next book, I'll start pulling them out and looking through it and see if one of them will work. The next year's book I'm working on right now, the Cop Malone story for next year, I came across when I was in a village north of London a couple of years ago, something that a woman there told me.
What kind of research do you do once you decide what story you're going to write?
Well, I start with books. I mean, I use around 300 to 400 books when I write any one of my novels. For Columbus, I had about 300 books on Christopher Columbus. I drive about 30 minutes from the house here up to a place called the Chamblin Book Mine, which is up in Jacksonville, Florida. It's a massive used bookstore with hundreds of thousands of books in there. And I go through the history section, which takes me, you know, a few hours to go through. And I find every book on the subject, and I put them in a box, and I buy them, and I bring them home. And I start going through them. And I go back to the Chamblin Book Mine regularly, maybe once a month, because he's getting stuff, new stuff in all the time. And that's where I get the majority of the books that I use. Special stuff that I need, I'll order online, particularly from Amazon UK, because the UK has some really cool history books they don't sell over here in this country. They have some very good stuff, and so I'll get some from there. And then there's at least one or two research trips per novel, and I get what I need on site.
That was the next question I was going to ask, because this novel, for example, takes place in several different locations around the world, including Florida and Jamaica. Do you travel to the places that you depict in the novels?
If I have to. I don't go just to go. It's because I can't find what I'm looking for in the books that I have. So in this case, in Prague, I could not find what I was looking for in the book, so we went. We had to go. We spent 4 days wandering the Prague, and I found what I was looking for on the ground there. And same with Jamaica. I went down. I did not know much about the Maroons, which are the only slaves in the Western Hemisphere who successfully fought and won their freedom. They're a separate culture in Jamaica, and I could not find what I was looking for here, so we went down there and we spent a couple of days with the Maroons, and we learned a lot about them, and we spent another 3 days wandering around Jamaica looking for the little nuggets that I needed to put this novel together, because there's a strong connection between Columbus and Jamaica. There's a very interesting connection there that figures into this book. So we go on site because we have to, not because we want to or that it's fun to do, because really these research trips are not fun at all. They're very stressful, in fact.
What makes them so stressful? It sounds fun to me.
No, not really, because you hit the ground and you have nothing. You know, otherwise I wouldn't be going if I had what I needed. So I've got to find it. If I don't find it, I've wasted time and money, and I have to hit the ground to find it, and it's a treasure hunt to find what I'm looking for. Now, before I go, I spend about a month researching the locale so I can narrow down my search. But like in Jamaica, well, like really in Prague, I wasn't finding what I was looking for, so I had to shift on the ground. I had to shift and make some decisions in the plot to make it work, and then I had to go and find what I was looking for there. So it's a little bit of a treasure hunt for me on the ground. And if I don't find it, you know, you've wasted a lot of time and energy, which, you know, is valuable when you have 12 months to produce a book. I can't waste any days.
During this research phase of writing a book, do you also start trying to flesh out the story? Do you do both things at the same time?
Yeah. It's simultaneously, yeah. The story is fleshing out as I'm doing the research, and that's why no one else can do the research but me, because no one knows the story but me. So I'm the only one who can actually do the hunt, and I do that hunt, and as I'm hunting, the plot is evolving and changing. It changed dramatically in Jamaica. We were walking up the side of this mountain with the Maroon colonel. The head of the Maroon community is called the colonel. And he took us up to the side of this mountain, up to these sugar ruins, which were quite magnificent. And we were walking up this mountain with him, and he was chatting with me, and he was answering my questions. And as he was answering my questions, he told me things I did not know, and the entire book changed on that trip up the side of that mountain.
When you are writing the story, you have all of this research that you've done, all of these facts from history, and of course, you are writing a novel. So there are things that we know about Christopher Columbus, but he becomes a character in your book. How constrained do you feel by the facts of history?
Well, I have to be careful in some respects because I want to try to keep it as accurate as I possibly can. I mean, I really do. But by the same token, I'm not constrained by it because I am writing a novel, And that's the fun part. I'm not writing a history book. I'm writing a novel that's designed to entertain you. So in the prologue of The Columbus Affair, for example, there's a scene that takes place on Jamaica in 1504, and it's somewhat accurate because Columbus, you know, there's some of that is accurate of what happened, but then I take some liberties with it, and I make some changes to it. And that's the fun part about a novel. Now, in my case, and so the reader will know what I've done, I always put an extensive writer's note in the back of the book that tells you where I play games with it so that you won't think that that's real when it's not.
You're also, in this book, you're inspired by someone's theory about Christopher Columbus.
Yes.
As you were exploring that theory, did you find historical information to back it up?
Yes, there's more of it now to back up. When the book that I found was written, it was 40 years ago, and the information on this was a little bit more limited than we had now. So there's a lot more that has come out. I have to be careful what I say here because I don't want to give away the book, but let's just say that 40 years ago there were things not available that are available now, which makes it a little more probable that this theory could in fact be true. The research that was done in that book is phenomenal, and the documents exist, and they are real. And like I said, it's just one of those mysteries of Columbus. See, we know nothing about Christopher Columbus. I mean, we don't know where he was born, where he was raised. We don't know what he looked like. We don't know who his parents were. He was an expert seaman, but we have no clue how he became one. How he got to America, we don't know. The chart's lost. What happened when he got here? The Journal of Columbus is a copy of a copy, so you can see how accurate that is. We know nothing of this man. And then there's this new secret, this new mystery associated with him, which is quite remarkable. And it was fun to explore it because it was something that once was kind of out in left field, which now may very well be true.
As you write these books, and in this case you're playing with a historical theory that has some facts to support it, do you ever concern yourself, do you ever think, I hope that people aren't taking this as a historical text?
Well, I mean, you said, do I worry if they think it's true?
Right. I mean, if they're using this in place of a history book.
Oh, yeah, I worry about that all the time. There are people who read my novels all the time who get their history from my novels. And that's not necessarily a good thing because I'm not a historian. I don't profess to be one. But I am a guy who's read 300 books on a particular subject, and I am a guy who's taken a few liberties with it, and I am a guy who's woven a tale trying to keep it as accurate as I can. And I give you the writer's note in the back so that you can know where I messed up or where I changed it. And you can also go do some further research and looking into subject matter. So what I'm hoping is that people don't get their history really from me, but they get their imagination spurred by me. That's what I'm hoping for.
I'm talking with best-selling novelist Steve Barry. His latest book is called The Columbus Affair. We'll also in a moment talk about historic preservation. He and his wife 2 years ago founded a foundation called History Matters. We'll talk about his work, and also he'll be coming to Des Moines. I'll give you the details on that as well when we get back. And you're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and my guest right now is best-selling novelist Steve Barry. His latest novel is called The Columbus Affair, and he's coming to Des Moines this week. On Thursday, he'll be speaking as part of the AVID series with the Des Moines Public Library. He'll be speaking at the Scottish Rite Consistory at 7 p.m. on Thursday. And also, he'll be involved in a number of other events over the weekend in Des Moines that have to do with historic preservation. And you're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Steve, you've already inspired somebody this hour. Michael says on Twitter, holy cow, I think your guest just told me to start writing. Thanks.
Good. So that little voice, see?
That's right. So when you did first start writing, listening to that little voice and putting the words on paper, do you remember what that first project was that sat down to work on?
It's sitting right next to me right now. I'm looking at it as we speak. It was a novel. I wrote it. It was 170,000 words long. It's the most horrible thing you've ever read in your life. It's just pathetic. I think I actually did something incredible. I wrote the entire thing in passive voice, which is amazing. which you should never do under any circumstance. But there's something about that manuscript, and that's why I keep it here, where I can see it every day. It's precious to me. It's the greatest thing probably I've ever written in my entire life. And you know what it is? It's that I finished it. I started it, and I finished it. 99.9% of all writers do not finish what they start. And I finished that thing. It was horrible, but I did it. And then I wrote another one that was horrible, and I wrote another one that was horrible. And then I figured out writing books is hard stuff. And I got myself into a writer's workshop, and I went every Wednesday night for 6 years, and I taught myself the craft of writing. And I still teach myself the craft of writing to this day. Every day I teach myself something else. Every day. It's a learning process that never stops.
When you were growing up, did you write short stories? Was this ever something that called to you as a child?
I tinkered with it. Now, thinking back on it, I remember writing something here and there, just tinkering with it. It didn't really begin to really nag at me until the 1980s after I started practicing law. Of course, I was writing a lot of legal writing and a lot of stuff there, but this urge to write fiction, I remember distinctly around 1988, 87, 88, I actually did start to write something once, and it was, and I quit, like 99.9% of all writers do. I stopped. It was 3 years later when I sat down and did it, and that time I didn't quit. And since June of 1990, there hasn't been a day that's gone by that I haven't been either thinking about what to write or writing itself. I've done around 17 manuscripts since June of 1990.
How did you find the time? And working as a lawyer, which when you talk about a passive voice, I can't think of any profession that would have prepared you better for writing in passive voice.
Oh, no question. No question.
Right?
Yeah.
But when you started writing, how did your family respond?
Not at all, because I didn't tell anybody, really. I wrote in the mornings from around 6:30 to 9. I didn't bother anybody. I did it before work at my office by myself. My wife at the time, she was home and I was at work, and it never interfered with anything because I went to work at 6:30 in the morning, and my wife at the time worked with me. She'd come to work about noon and she'd work in the afternoon. So nobody really ever saw or knew what I was doing. I kind of just did it myself by myself. I didn't really tell anybody. My secretaries knew, but that was about all. You know, the people in the office knew, but nobody paid any attention to it, to be honest with you. It was just one of those things, you know, and every Wednesday night I'd go to my class. And then in 2003, when The Amber Room was published, you know, the town found out about it. And everybody said, wow, you've been writing. Well, I'd been writing 13 years at that point, but nobody knew.
How did people respond when you did tell them? I mean, the people close to you.
Well, they were very surprised. I mean, you know, my wife at the time, she knew. I mean, she knew it, and she knew I was doing it, but she also knew about all the rejection too. And she would go with me to the writer's workshop on Wednesday nights and do it. So she was aware of it, yes. But the rest of everybody was sort of surprised, like, wow, you write books. And you did it, and it got published, and then, you know, that book was, you know, successful, and then I was very lucky. Each book after that sort of began to build on it. But the local community where we lived in St. Mary's, nobody really cared that I was a writer. They only cared that I was a county commissioner to take care of their problems, and I was a lawyer who dealt with it. The writing was just something they never paid much attention to be honest with you.
You said you got a lot of rejections. I think 85 rejections is what it says in your official bio. Was there something in one of those rejections that you were able to take as encouragement?
No, not a thing. Not a thing. If you took the 85 rejections and you broke them up, you would have two piles. One pile says, I hate your characters, but I love your story. And the other says, I hate your story, but I love your characters. And they would literally come one after the other. Now, you might say, what's that telling you? That seems very contradictory. Now, what it's telling you is they're not finding something wrong with the book across the board. It's just not the right story at the right time. And that was my problem. I was writing international suspense thrillers, and the genre died in 1990. And all during the 90s, I'm trying to sell an international suspense thriller, and no editor's buying them because the genre is gone. And then Random House bought The Da Vinci Code. And The Da Vinci Code brought the genre back. But it came back not as a spy thriller, but as action, history, secrets, conspiracy, international settings. Guess what I was writing? That's what I was writing. So I got bought to go with the Da Vinci Code to become a, you know, the companion with inside Random House for this kind of book. And Dan and Doubleday, you know, Dan Brown and Doubleday, we owe them a great debt, because together they brought this genre back to life, and they gave a lot of writers that I know, me myself included, a chance to be published.
So you say it died in 1990 with the end of the Cold War?
Yes, ma'am. When the Berlin Wall fell and the Soviet Union crumbled, that was the end of the spy thriller. If you were Robert Ludlum or John Le Carré or Clive Cussler or somebody like that, you were fine. But if you were Steve Barry trying to break in, you were dead, because editors just weren't buying it. The spy novel went away. It still really hasn't come back. The spy novel is really essentially gone. The international suspense thriller is thriving, but it's a different format now. It's a different formula now than it was prior to 1990.
I'm talking with best-selling novelist Steve Barry. His latest novel is called The Columbus Affair, and you're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Dave is on the line from Norwalk. Hi, Dave.
Hey, thanks so much for taking my call, Charity. Hi, Steve. Steve, I'm a writer. Got one novel under my belt. I really want to quit writing novels, but I can't. I have the same affliction you have. I'll see you on Thursday night. But how do you keep it going? I'm not a wimpy guy, but I'm at my wit's end.
Well, you gotta
please
hang,
help.
You gotta hang with it. You don't quit. You can't. I'm living proof you can do it. You realize that 11 years ago, I couldn't give away a manuscript. I couldn't say, I will give you one of my manuscripts free if you'll publish it. Now I'm in 50 countries around the world. I'm living proof you can do it. So, you know, you got to take some heart in that. I would recommend, if you can, to come to the writer's workshop that we're having on June 2nd, you know, on Saturday there in Des Moines. That's going to be a great workshop, and we're going to talk about the craft of writing, the business of writing, all kinds of cool stuff there in 4 hours that for all the writers out there, whether you want to be published or not published, you got to realize 99% of most writers don't publish. This workshop's for everyone. I'd recommend you come to the workshop. I think you'll get some good inspiration from that.
All right, that's on June 2nd at the Des Moines Public Library. And you are going to be doing a lot of events when you're in Des Moines. You're coming as part of the AVID lecture series. That's going to be Thursday night at 7 p.m. And then you're doing a History Matters workshop at the Terrace Hill Governor's Mansion on June 1st. And let's talk about History Matters. Obviously, you are someone who cares deeply about history. It has been the inspiration for your career as a best-selling novelist. Have you always been a history buff?
Yes, I've always liked history. That I do recall going all the way back. I've always read history. I've always enjoyed it. And I tell people all the time, don't write what you know. Write what you know is horrible advice. It's the worst advice you can give somebody. Instead, write what you love. What you know and what you love are the same thing. Great. But if it's not, write what you love. And I loved action, history, secrets, conspiracy, international settings, and particularly the history aspect of it. So I've always gravitated to that. And when I started to write, that's what I did. I wrote what I loved. Now, the first novel I did, the first manuscript that did, I wrote what I knew. And that's when I figured out that was very bad advice. I was a trial lawyer for 30 years. I can try you. You know, I can defend you for murder. I did thousands of divorces. I did courtroom stuff constantly. But I found out very quickly I didn't want to write about that.
That's an area where a lot of people have found a lot of success. Why didn't you want to write about it?
Because that's what I did every day, all day long. So I wanted to write to escape that. And so the action, history, secrets, conspiracy, international settings allowed me to escape it. You see, I was seeing people at their worst. I mean, they're either charged with a crime or they're involved in a divorce, and it's bitter, it's horrible. I did probably 10,000 divorces in my 30-year career. I did enormous amounts of them. And it was just seeing people at their worst. I wanted to get away from that. I wanted to escape it. And so that's why I gravitated to what I write.
That must come in handy for you, though. Having just read The Columbus Affair, there are certainly elements of horrible divorces and all kinds of other things going on in there as well. So does that give you a deep well to draw from?
Yeah, it creeps in. There's no question about it. With Cotton Malone, my recurring character, who took the year off this year so I could write the standalone, there's a lot of it that creeps in there, just creeps in here and there to it. But I don't know if I would want to write an entire book about it, to do it, because, as I said, I lived it and did it. I'm not going to say never, because you never know what you might want to do, but I sure like the action, history, secrets, conspiracy, international settings kind of thing.
You and your wife founded History Matters in 2010, so just a couple of years ago. Tell me about the foundation.
Well, we it's a way to raise money for historic preservation around the country, because we notice there's not a dime out there for it anymore. So we've got to come up with some new ways to do it. And we partner with local communities. We just did one in Houston, which was really good. They have a flag there that they found in a garage. It's the city of Houston's very first flag. And they found it in a person's garage, but it's in terrible condition, and it needs to be renovated. And so we partnered with Houston. I come into town. I did a luncheon for them, which they sold tickets to, and I spoke and took questions and all kinds of things for about an hour and interacted with everyone. And then I taught a writer's workshop afterwards for a group of writers and folks with that little voice in their head, and I taught for 4 hours there, and we raised $25,000 in an afternoon. And we raised that to restore that flag. There's an example of a partnership that we have. It's a conduit. Elizabeth and I don't charge to come History Matters events. We don't charge to expenses. I pay for that out of my own pocket. And we do about 12 to 15 of these around the country each year. And that's why we're coming to Des Moines. We're going to do some stuff up there to do. And it's a way to help local communities raise money.
Was there a specific need that you saw that inspired you?
Yes, no question about it. I was in Oregon, and an archivist came up to me and said, I want to tell you something. I don't know if you know this. There's millions of documents in repositories around this country right now, millions of them. And I want you to think about this. One every second of every day, another word of ink fades away on a page. Every second. A word fades away. Another word fades away. Another word fades away. Imagine what we're losing. We simply cannot read it anymore. It's gone. It's vanished forever. And all because we don't take care of it, or we haven't preserved it. We haven't done what we had to do. And I never realized that. And it hit me, and I went like, wow, he's got a point there. So that's why we decided, let's see what we can do. And we've helped out all over. We've helped historic cemeteries. We did the P.T. Barnum posters at the P.T. Barnum Museum. We've done old buildings. We did the rare book room at the University of the Library of Virginia. This fall, we're doing a really incredible one at the Smithsonian, where we're going to do it, raise money for the Smithsonian, and you're going to get a private tour of the rare book room as part of it. And we're doing something at the Mark Twain House later this year with R.L. Stine and Sandra Brown. So it's catching on, and this partnership is working, and we're able to help out, local communities.
What made you want to start your own organization as opposed to joining forces with one of the other organizations out
Because
there?
We have a unique way of doing it. We do something very unique here. These writers' workshops are very unique. I basically whittled down in 4 hours what I learned in 12 years, and you get quite an experience. I've taught around 1,600 students now around the country, and it's a unique way to draw writers into historic preservation. And it's working. It's catching on to do. And these galas and luncheons we do are a unique way to draw readers in to historic preservation. So not only are we raising money, we're also raising awareness. And it gave us a way to do it in our way and in the way we'd like to do it.
Mike is on the line from Des Moines at 866-780-9100. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What's your question?
Well, I'm a writer, and I've done a few short stories, and I'd really like to get them published. And like Steve said, I'd like to start a writer's group, a weekly thing, but I'm having a heck of time finding other writers to communicate with. And I was wondering, when you went to your weekly Wednesday writer's group, how did you initially find the writers or the group that you went to?
Well, I was lucky. Another writer suggested me to it, and I stumbled onto an excellent group. This is one thing that we can do. I encourage you to come to the workshop next Saturday, because I encourage the people in the workshop to form their own writer's groups.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're going to hear, for those 4 hours, you're going to hear some things that are probably going to open your eyes, and then together y'all can judge each other's work. Based on what you learn there.
Mm-hmm.
And the cool thing about today is you don't have to even be in the same town to have a writer's workshop. You can scan in your manuscript, send it to each other, Skype in, and do it online. We didn't have that kind of technology. We had to go meet at a location to do it. So you have to search around. It's hard to find the right group.
Right.
But at the writer's workshop, you might come across it. We've had lots of writer's workshops formed, writer's groups formed out of our workshops because we encourage it. So if you can come next Saturday, I would encourage you to do it.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right, Mike, thanks a lot for your call. And if you'd like to join our conversation, you can at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You said it sometimes it's hard to find the right group. What makes a writer's workshop right?
You got to get the right mix of personality who understand. It's a brutal experience. I don't know if you've ever done it. You take your manuscript, you read your page out, you read your chapter out loud, and the group destroys it. They just destroy it. And they're judging it on craft. We never talk about story. That's one thing a writer's group has to do. Story is irrelevant. It's about craft, because craft is craft across the board. You have to learn to keep your mouth shut and your ears open. And you have to, and everyone has to take their time up front. You can't just be there to complain. You've got to also take your time up front, too. And hopefully you want the people to be as honest with you as you're being with them. Now, here's the thing about a writer's group. 75% of what you hear in a writer's group is pure garbage. You never want to remember it as long as you live. 25% of it, though, is absolute gold. Pure gold.
We're going to take a quick break here, Steve. I'm talking with best-selling novelist Steve Barry. We'll be back in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and my guest today is best-selling novelist Steve Barry. He's going to be in Des Moines this week. Thursday evening, he'll be speaking as part of the AVID series with the Des Moines Public Library. He'll be speaking at the Scottish Rite Conservancy, or Consistory is what I'm trying to say. And Thursday evening at 7, he'll also be in Des Moines for the weekend doing a writer's workshop at the Des Moines Public Library and also some History Matters appearances as well. And Steve, we were talking about History Matters, the foundation you started with your wife a couple of years ago to help raise money for historic preservation. How do you decide which projects you're going to get involved in?
Well, we take a look at them. I mean, we try to accommodate as many as we possibly can. We can't do everything. So we look at it from a scheduling standpoint. We look at what works for them. Can we fit it in? I can't be gone all the time because I'd have to write the book. So we try to do, you know, one event a month, and we try to think it through. And if we can work it into the schedule, we can make it work, and we get the right partnership. That's the key. It's a partnership. It's just not about me showing up. It's about them also using that opportunity to maximize it, like the folks in Houston did. They maximized that opportunity and raised that $25,000 in an afternoon, which was really well done.
But how do you decide if it's worth getting involved in?
Well, we have to talk to the people involved. We have to make some educated assessments. I have a lady who works for me, Esther, who runs the foundation, and she's gotten good at kind of talking it through and seeing if someone's serious about it. You know, we're not there just to come and we don't give you money, obviously. We're helping you raise money. So we have to find and make sure that the organizers are excited enough about it and can go out and tap into their resources and use me as a way to raise money. You know, like normally, if I call you up and say, look, you know, we're going to have this dinner and it's $100 a head and it's all going to historic preservation, they go, well, okay, so what? I mean, I don't want to do it. But if you call up and say, look, well, you know, we've got a New York Times writer, best-selling writer coming into town. He's going to talk about his new book, The Columbus Affair. He's going to answer your questions. We can talk about all these cool things. There'll be books there for you to get and take a look at, all this kind of stuff. And in return, the same $100 you're going to give us is still going to go to historic preservation, but you're going to get this in conjunction with that. It's just an easier way to make the sale.
You mentioned earlier that you're hoping to inspire readers of your novels to get involved in historic preservation. What do you want all of us to think about as we look around the world? What are you hoping to inspire?
I'm hoping to inspire that things go away. It disappears. If you're not careful, you can lose some very important things, very important things. The Library of Alexandria was the greatest repository of knowledge in the ancient world. And it simply rotted away. They just let it rot away to nothing. We can't do that. We have to be conscious of our heritage, conscious of our of where we came from, and preserve it. Now, we can't preserve it all. Unfortunately, we can't preserve it all. But we're going to have to make a conscious effort to preserve what needs to be preserved and what has to be preserved. Now, if we can do it all, it's great. There's just so much to do. But we have to focus on certain things. For example, the rare book room at the Library of Virginia, there are some precious volumes in there. We can't let the ink fade off those pages. We have to save every one of those books.
And how do you do that?
Money. That's how you do it. Unfortunately, it takes money to do that stuff. Money comes from awareness. If you get people aware, they get involved. They get involved, they do it. There's a great saying. It says, if you tell me, I'll forget. If you show me, you'll involve me. If you involve me, I'll understand. And that's what we're trying to do here, to do it. We're trying to involve them in the process so they can see it. The cool thing about, like, in Houston, they had the flag there. They had it there in a glass case, and you could see the state of its disrepair, what needed to be done. And they were showing you, look, here it is. You get it? Yeah, I got it. I understand. You've involved me. My $200 I'm giving you is going to help save that flag. And in return, I'm going to get an afternoon here. We're going to have a nice discussion about this book. I'm going to have a lovely lunch. And I'm going to have a writer's workshop where I'm going to learn about the craft of writing. But in the end, that flag's going to get saved. That's what it's all about.
Here in Iowa, we have, of course, a rich rural history. And if you drive around in rural areas in Iowa, you'll see some very beautiful structures. You'll also see many that have fallen into disrepair, what I call rural blight, where, you know, things have just been neglected over many years. And new buildings have been built nearby for new purposes, but we just kind of have junk lying around. So we all come in contact with history all the time, although it may not be in a very attractive package. Do you have a recommendation for how we should look at this kind of interaction?
Well, as I said, you can't save it all. It can't be done. So some decisions have to be made and choices have to be made. And those are experts have to make some of those choices, but sometimes no. Sometimes just communities make those choices where they say, we'd like to save this building. We want this building. This building is important to us. This building has a connection to us, and we want to save it. So it's really just, you know, who makes the call, who can raise enough awareness, who can get the money to do it, and who can follow through and make it happen. That's the great thing about historic preservation. Anybody can make it happen. Anybody.
There are people involved in massive projects now to digitize some of these old books and some of this old history. How do you feel about that?
No question needs to be done, because at least the information will be saved. At the very minimum, we will have the information available to us. Yes, we should save the original article if possible. But unfortunately, with paper and with things like that, there's an end day. Paper deteriorates. There's a time when it goes back to dust, and that time comes. So yes, digitization is critical to at least have the information available, so that ink that's fading off the page every second, we can put an end to that. So no, I'm very much in favor of digitization.
Given your love of history and your need for all of these historical documents, do you find yourself going online more and more to do research?
Just to get started, I do a online research. What I do with that is a way to tantalize my brain, point me in a direction. I'm very cautious of any information that comes off the internet, you know, as far as where it comes from. I'm very, very cautious about its authenticity and all. So if I find something that really interests me off the internet, I immediately start about the old-fashioned way of getting the books out and seeing if it's real.
With the writing, with the foundation, with all that you do, and do you have, you've been bringing out about a novel once a year. Do you have a contract for a novel once a year?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so
yes.
This is going to keep on going. That sounds like just an enormous amount of work. How long does it take you to actually sit down and write the novel?
It's 12 months to write it, but it's 18 months from start to finish. And so what happens is, like right now, I'm writing next year's book, and I'll be done with it here very shortly. You stay a year ahead in the book business, so I'll be done shortly. But I've been researching the year after's book so that when I stop writing next year's book in about a month, I'm ready to go immediately on the one after. So I do 6 months of preliminary research while I'm writing the other. When you do a book a year, you will always have three in your brain, always. Right now, I actually have four in my brain because I'm promoting this year's book with Columbus. I'm writing next year's book. I'm plotting and researching the year after, and I'm conceptualizing the one after that. Now, this year's book will go away in about another month. It will not be prominent in my brain anymore. The tour will be over, and it will kind of fade away. And I'll only have three in my brain. It's normally three is what always happens. It's just one of those things if you're going to do a book a year. But during those 12 years of rejection, when I wrote those manuscripts, I taught myself how to write a book a year during that time.
What's your process like when you actually sit down? What kind of space do you write in?
I have a desk in Credenza. I'm sitting at it right now, and it's the desk in Credenza that I've written every book at. It came from my old office. I don't have my office anymore. I sold it when I quit practicing law 3 years ago, but I brought the desk in Credenza with me. And so I have an office here at the house, and I go in there, and I sit down every morning, and I work from around 6:30 to about 11 every morning. And I bang out my 1,000 to 1,500 words. And if you'll do that religiously 5 days a week, you'll have a book in about 12 months.
We were talking last week on the show about the creative process and how it's different, of course, for different people, but how sometimes sitting down and focusing on something is sort of the enemy of creativity and the imagination. When you get stuck, what do you do to kind of shake the ideas loose?
I go out. I walk right outside, and I get my golf clubs, and I go and I hit some golf balls, or I walk a few holes of golf. We live on a golf course, and that's my way of cleaning my head out. I'll go out there and just walk. And you'll be surprised. I plotted an enormous amount of stuff walking on the golf course, just in the nice sunshine, walking and hitting the ball and thinking and get you clear head. Usually it clears my head right out and I'm ready to go.
And are you often able to sit down for 6 hours and write?
No. You don't sit there for the whole 6 hours. You're up and down and doing things. Probably out of the 6 hours, you're actually pounding that keyboard maybe half that. You know, to do, you're thinking about it, you're plotting, you're refixing. You know, you got to realize a writer spends 90% of their time thinking about what to write and 10% of their time actually writing it. That's the breakdown if you actually did an inventory of it. Now, I don't want to spend a lot of time thinking about what to write while I'm writing, but because you do will waste time. But there are things that change and evolve as I'm going along that day. And I'll work for 20 minutes, stop for a little bit, work for 20 minutes, stop for a little bit. Your brain... There's no way I could sit there and just go for 6 hours. I'd be fried.
Where do you find the time to get new inspiration? I mean, it just sounds like such a grind.
It's a little bit of a problem because when you first start writing, your imagination bank is crammed full because you've made so many deposits into that bank, and you start withdrawing and withdrawing because it's loaded up. My imagination bank has been, there's been more withdrawals than deposits. I won't say that that's not the case. And for me, travel puts the deposits back in, where I can travel for fun and I can see new places and new things. You know, unfortunately, I don't do a lot of travel for fun anymore. It's all for business, but we try to combine it in. Like in Iowa, I'm coming up there, we're going to be working, but they're going to take me around and show me a lot of the local historical areas and those historical sites and all, and I'm going to get a good flavor for all of that. And you never know. That's where I put a deposit back into the bank, and I do more of that. I haven't had a vacation in 3 years. Last one I took was fun. We took it up into the Baltic states, and I put a lot of deposits there. But we're going to take a couple later this year, finally. So hopefully I'll get to make some deposits then, too.
Do you find yourself revisiting some of those early manuscripts and the ideas that you've already used as a writer but did not get published?
Well, three of the five that were submitted made it. Amber Room, Romanov Prophecy, Third Secret. The other five, two of them are unintelligible, the first and the second one. But the rest of it, I've stolen about 75% of those manuscripts and used them in the various books. I've taken a scene here, a scene there. So I've used up most of those words. That's why I tell writers all the time, do not throw your words away. You never know when you can use them.
Before you became a writer, were you a reader?
Oh, yes. You have to be. There's no way in the world you could be a writer without being a reader. That I was. I would read 4, 5, 6 books a month at least. And that was back when there were books. There was no such thing as e-books in those days. So I actually read books and, you know, 4, 5, 6 books a month, easy. Lots and lots of books was a reader. Now, not so much. I'll maybe read 6 to 8 books a year for fun. I do about 25 books a year for blurbing, where I read other people's books to give them a blurb, and then, of course, those 300 to 400 books that I have to read for the research.
Do you sleep?
Oh, yeah. You just disciplined it. I get my 7-8 hours at night. You just be disciplined. If you manage your time and your discipline, you can get it done. Yes, it can be done. It's just a matter of setting that discipline in place and sticking with it and holding tight. That's what the nuns taught me. That's the one thing I can remember from them. They taught me how to do that.
In Catholic school when you were growing up.
Yes, ma'am. I was in Catholic school, and they were tough now. I say all the time, the things that they used to do to you when you were bad, you go to prison for now. They actually put people in prison for, but they were tough. They were relentless, tough, actually in some cases brutal. But I remember their lessons well.
When you know that your opportunities to read are very limited, who do you make time for? Who writing right now do you read?
Oh, I read, I love Cussler. I read everything that he does. I read Jim Rollins. I read Lee Child, David Baldacci. I'm thriller junkies. I mean, I'm pretty much thrillers. If I stumble onto a thriller and it sounds good, I'll read it. Even if I don't know the writer, I'll come across something. You know, I'll read, if not all of it, good chunks of it to do. I just read the book, a nonfiction book, The President's Club, which was a pretty cool book. I actually was going to do a novel on something like that. That's what caught my eye. They wrote a nonfiction book about it to do. Things like that will catch my eye, and I'll take a look and read it. But for fun, I like a few thrillers every year, you know, that I read. Jim Rollins, anything he writes, I'll read all of that.
You have really reached the top of your game. It seems as a novelist, you are making a difference with History Matters, this foundation. What else is out there? What are the goals that are still on your horizon?
Well, you know, we all have, the main goal of a writer would be to just keep doing it. I want to keep doing it. I want to be able to keep going. And unfortunately, in the writing business, you're only as good as the last thing that you did. So you have to keep going. And my goal is just to keep going. And I won't fool you. I'm not going to sit here and say it. I know writers say it doesn't matter, but it does matter. I've made it to number 2 on the New York Times list. I would like to make it to number 1 one time. It would be kind of nice to get up in that number 1 slot there to do. The Columbus Affair came out this week, debuted at number 4, and I'm able to get in the top 5, but I haven't got to that number 1 slot yet. So one day, that goal I would like to achieve.
All right, and you've given us a little bit of a preview of the next novel. Tell me a little bit more.
You're talking about next year?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's I stumbled onto it in England. It's a great mystery and legend associated with the Tudors that could very well be real. And the more I researched it and looked into it, it could very well be real. It's called The Tudor Deception, and it's going to deal with Cot Malone and his son Gary. I can't tell you a whole lot more because I don't want to give it away, but it's really amazing. When the lady told me about it, I went, no, you're making that up. She said, no, come here, let me show you. And she took me and showed me this stuff, and sure enough, and so I was able to weave this very interesting tale about the Tudors that I know American audiences are going to go, that can't be real, but it could very well be.
Steve, thank you so much.
No problem. Great, and hopefully everybody will come out next week. I'd love to see everybody. It's my first trip to Iowa.
All right. Well, enjoy it. Steve Barry, best-selling novelist. His latest novel is called The Columbus Affair, and he will be spending several days in Iowa this week. On Thursday evening, he'll be speaking at 7 o'clock as part of the AVID series with the Des Moines Public Library. He'll be speaking at the Scottish Rite Consistory, and he'll also be doing a writer's workshop this weekend at the Des Moines Public Library, and he'll also be involved in some historic preservation appearances as well. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Catherine Perkins, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to talk about meditation in many different forms. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.